We're back with another week of Torah study and a brand new co-host. Rabbi Matt mentioned Rabbi Jess last week, and wowie, are you in for a treat? I usually do my own research for bios, but Jess sent this over, and I love it so much, I'm just going to read it. Rabbi Jessica Minin is a ritualist, liturgist, and anti-racist committed to the discipline of delight. A part of the founding team of One Table, she is now a consultant who helps Jewish organizations get out of the box, think bigger, and be better. She lives in Denver, Colorado, so for all our Denver listeners out there, a little bit of hometown love for you. This week we have a pretty wild Torah portion, and there's a lot going on. Jess will mention a kind of bee story, that of Tzelofchad's daughters, and it's one of my favorites, so I'm going to give you some context since we don't really get into it all that much. Basically, back in biblical days, when someone died, their belongings and land went to their eldest son, and if they had no sons, it would basically be given away, or at the very least debated on what to do with it. No mention of daughters. So when this guy, Tzelofchad, who had daughters but no sons, passed away, the women go to Moses and say, "Hey, this rule isn't really fair. We think we should inherit the land." Moses goes to God to say, "What the heck do I do about this?" And God says, "They're absolutely right." And while it may now seem like, yeah, of course they're absolutely right, I love that there's this idea here that sometimes God can be led to righteousness through us. And no matter your religious leaning, I'd go ahead and argue that all righteousness is steered by those paving the path. So keep paving, my friends. There's a lot of other stuff that happens, and Jess will explain, but a theme that keeps showing itself in both the Torah as a whole, and this parsha specifically, is that of idolatry, and the seeming threat that it poses to the Jewish people, or God, and we'll talk about that distinction. We found a really beautiful Heschel quote about idolatry, which I'll read in a bit, and that made us want to talk to Rabbi Shai Held, president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at Hadar Institute in New York City. Rabbi Held is the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, which studies the major themes of Heschel's works, and he is currently writing a new piece specifically about the relationship between idolatry and Heschel. So, well, here we are. Plenty to discuss, as always. I'm so excited for you to meet Jess. If you're finding as much meaning in all this as I am, you can help us out by rating and reviewing wherever you get your podcasts. Support the show in a very tangible way by throwing us whatever you can at patreon.com/thestudy. Reach out and let us know what you're thinking on Twitter @study_show. And you can always invite a friend to listen. Summer is in full swing. Stay cool out there. Drink your water. On to the show. I'm very excited to welcome Rabbi Jess Minin to the study for her first episode as co-host, coming to us from Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Jess.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And today's guest, we are so lucky to be in conversation with Rabbi Shai Held, president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at Hadar Institute on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, New York. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I think we should just dive in. Rabbi Jess, would you be so kind to give us a summary of this week's Torah portion, perhaps with a focus on Pinchas and his response to idolatry?
I will. Oh, Pinchas. We are in Numbers, the book of Bamidbar, Numbers chapter 25, and we are starting with the story of Pinchas, a very complicated character, and the way that he reacts to some of the communal behavior that he believes is outside the norm of the monotheistic cultic setting that the Israelites are setting up. We're going to come back to that. We're going to put a pin in it for a hot second because I want to tell you about the rest of the portion first. A lot of stuff. A lot of stuff is going on in this parsha, in this portion. In chapter 26, we have another census. I say another because the book of Numbers, the book of Bamidbar, begins with a census. And then we have 45 verses of lineage, i.e., this is the person who's the son of so-and-so, who's the son of so-and-so. So I have a note. Woe is the kid who gets this portion for his bar mitzvah. It's just a lot of lineage. And it's going to become important in a second when we talk about the role that lineage plays in the story of Pinchas. We'll get to that a little bit later. There's also a holler back, a reference to the story of the spies, the fact that the generation of the Exodus is going to die out in the wilderness and not enter the promised land, except for Caleb and Joshua. That's a callback to an earlier story about who gets to move forward and who has to stay behind. In chapter 27, we have one of my favorites, the daughters of Zelophehad. This is an important story because we have women and they have names and they have a speaking role. And in the Torah, that's a big deal. If you get a name and you get something to say, it really matters, especially if you're a female character. And it's a nice counterbalance to some of the action we have with female characters in the Pinchas story. We have some really important language that I want to highlight really quickly with the daughters of Zelophehad around Tina Lanu Achuza, give us a holding. So they're actually coming and saying, ain't no brothers here, ain't no men to inherit anything. Give us a holding. And then God actually echoes that language in the way that we describe emphasis in the Torah, which is repeating with emphasis, repeating verbs, and then repeating nouns emphatically. So God then comes and says, no tem titan lahem achuzat nachala, which is, yes, you shall surely give them a secure holding. So we have big God energy echoing the voices of women. We also have the final dialogue between God and Moses, between God and Moshe. God will speak to and through Moses throughout the rest of Bamidbar and Devarim, but they are not in dialogue again. And that's really important because we have another holler back to the Water from the Rock episode, which reminds us that just like the generation of the Exodus is going to die out and not get to enter the promised land, Moses isn't going to get any either. And then finally in that chapter, we have a little bit of the story of smicha, the laying of hands, which is how leadership is passed on from Moses to Joshua and how leadership is still passed on to this day. If you become a rabbi, that process is called smicha. And the Parsha concludes with chapters 28, 29, and 30. 28 and 29 are taking us back to the idea of how to be in relationship with God, and how we do that through korbanot, our sacrifices. We have the sacrifices around a lot of the chagim, a lot of the holidays, Passover, Shavuot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, etc. And so a lot of our holiday Torah readings over the course of the year are actually drawn from these chapters. And there's a real emphasis on time and the fixed seasonal agrarian nature of what becomes the cycle of Jewish time. And then lastly, in chapter 30, we have some discussion of nidarim or vows. So do what you say you're going to do, bli nader, right? If you say you're going to do it, if you make a vow, you need to do it. And there's also some conversation about who's responsible for folks who can't necessarily make vows on their own, i.e. women. And there's some conversation around father-daughter relationships and husband-wife relationships and who's responsible for who. So I put a pin in Pinchas. Let's go back to that for a second. We're going to focus for the bulk of our podcast today on this particular story. Oh, Pinchas. And again, in English, in King James, you're going to see Pinchas rendered as Phineas, right? So this is for all you Phineas and Ferb fans. I see you. I hear you. This is Pinchas. This is the namesake. Vayachal ha'am, please note, Pinchas comes in and sees the people twisting, or a great way to think about this would be profaning. Robert Alter, one of my favorite translators, used the language around whoring, right? So there's a sexual nature here of something that the people are doing. We know that the verb liznot is about sex work. We know that from other stories that we've had all the way back to Genesis, Judah and Tamar, etc. So there's some kind of clear allusion that whatever the people are engaged in, that there's a sexual nature and an idolatrous nature, i.e. cultic prostitution. You're cheating on God. We're supposed to be in a relationship, right? And you out there doing whatever else with whatever, with all these other gods. And this is what Pinchas acts against. And it's a couple other things we really need to name before we move on. One is that the narrative clearly places women, specifically Moabite and Midianite women, which is really interesting given the roles Moabite and Midianite women play in different parts of the text, who are essentially luring Israelite men into these sexual idolatrous relationships. And Rashi, one of the great medieval commentators, says, you know, the men were seized by their sexual impulses. The women would say, let's do this thing. And the men would be seized by these impulses, say, submit to me. And then at this moment, she would reveal an image of Baal Peor, which we just heard about in the parsha before this. An image of the idol from her lap, euphemism for vagina, my friends. We are talking very specifically about sex. And say to him, you want this? Bow down to this. So you can't really divorce the sexual nature of what's going on here from the idolatrous nature. And we'll pick up that, more on that in a minute. So God says, kill the leaders, the chiefs of the Jewish people. This is a throwback to Yitro. We'll talk more about that later as well. And Moses gives the order to kill those men who are clinging to these idols, clinging to the idols of the people around them, Baal Peor. And this is when a man, a nameless man for now, shows up with a Midianite woman before the eyes of the whole community. And at the entrance of the Ohel HaMoed, the tent of meeting, this is like, don't shit where you eat, people. Like, this is just, it's mind-boggling of all the places to get together. It's at the Petach Inayim, right? Another callback to the Judah and Tamar story. Like, of all the places to do the thing, they show up at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and Pinchas freaks out, like, literally. Stabs them both, and we'll talk more about where and how they are stabbed. And then the text goes on to say that because Pinchas acted in this way, mass casualties were averted. And the text uses plague language to talk about what would have happened if Pinchas had not acted in this way. And God is like, word, nice work, my dude. And the language evolves into language around reward, a brit shalom, a covenant of peace, a perpetual priesthood. So it's really hard to read this and criticize Pinchas, although I will do plenty of that later, because the text seems pretty clear, at least from a pshat or surface level, that God is praising Pinchas's actions here.
This is a parsha chock full of stuff, and I think one of the most important things to bring to the table is just that I actually was in the pilot of Phineas and Ferb, and now I think we should do bring it back as Pinchas and Ferb.
Oh my God, I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
Anyway, you know, as you said, Pinchas is pretty problematic here, and it seems like the Torah is telling us that Pinchas is in the right. What are we actually supposed to take from his actions, if not reading this Torah portion, more literally?
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting. Like, what are we supposed to believe, right? And supposed to believe, I'm putting in air quotes, my friend. So just a quick aside about how I choose to engage with the text is not as a literal document, but as a story that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And so I'm always asking, trying to hold tradition in one hand and innovation or modernity and my life, my lived life in 2021 in the other, and say, okay, great, let's figure out what it meant then and what it can mean for me now. Otherwise, it's just sitting somewhere in the middle, meaning nothing. So my hot take is that Pinchas was nuts. He's a fundamentalist. I think Pinchas is a really dangerous example. And you see this still today of the harm and pain that can be caused in the name of religion when people act in these very sort of impassioned ways without a lot of thought. On the other hand, right, the harder question is less like what to think of Pinchas and more what to do about my relationship with that power greater than myself that I choose to call God or Adonai. And this God who is pretty clearly praising this behavior, which I abhor. So what do I do about that? And that's why I love the thing, right? That's why I get so engaged in the text, because it's asking me to navigate and negotiate. It's not saying there's one thing to think or one thing to believe, right? And you see this in the evolution of rabbinic commentary as well on Pinchas's actions.
So one thing I would just throw in here that I think is interesting is that even some traditional thinkers who don't want to go where you go, Jess, who don't want to say, oh, you know, I choose to hold in one hand the tradition and the other hand my experience, will nevertheless find ways to read, depending on how you see these, either with the grain or against the grain. I think, for example, of Menachem Mendel of Kutz, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, who observes in a really interesting comment that it's striking that Pinchas is not chosen as the heir to Moshe. And he says the reason for that is that a person who's a firebrand, who's a zealot, can't be a leader. You ultimately can't lead people if your fundamental impulse is to be angry with them. So on the one hand, the Kutzker is never going to say, well, this is, you know, a human text. It's not meant to be read literally. On the other hand, he's going to find ways to register discomfort and protest from sort of within the language of the tradition itself. And I think that that's important to keep in mind here. Pinchas is a complex character, and moderns are not the first people to see that. I think you can maybe say that what moderns have available to them is a different range of possible responses to the discomfort. But the discomfort itself goes mm-hmm. very far back.
I love that. You see that in the responses in the Mishnah and Gemara as well, right? There's this idea of like, this can't possibly be praiseworthy. And there's this explanation in the Mishnah that's like, okay, you know, yes, there are cases where it's okay to act in this way. And then in the Talmud, you see this incredible, like expansive, like, but not here and not here and not here. And instead this focus on, as you mentioned, Shai, around lineage and why lineage proceeds in the with the priesthood, the lineage of the priesthood and the lineage of prophecy and the lineage of leadership. Like, why isn't Pinchas the inheritor of that? I hadn't read the Kutz, but I love that.
Sorry, one thing you could add here actually is that the language of giving Pinchas a brit shalom is on the one a covenant of peace is on the one hand a reward, but may also be a kind of critique. What is the best thing you can give someone who's a zealot? A little bit of peace, mm-hmm. a little bit of calm, right? So there's a way in which even the text might be saying, you know, might be trying to hold at one of the same time the idea that Pinchas's act is on its own terms meritorious and also dangerous and problematic. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one thing that the sages in general do, that rabbinic tradition does with almost any text that has explosive potential, is at minimum to find a way to render it non-precedential. That is to say, you can't read this text and say, oh, and therefore, if I don't like how Raviv is acting, I find it threatening to the covenant, I'll just murder him because it's, you know, one less infidel, right?
I appreciate
you can't
that.
Do that. And you find that just, you know, to take the most obvious example, the text in the Chumash and the Pentateuch that the most number of people find uncomfortable, the mandate to wipe out the Canaanites, the rabbis worked very hard to make sure, you know, that was a one-time thing. And so, again, they're not going to ever say, oh, this text is problematic, but they're going to find a way to say this text is not a precedent for anyone to act on in the present. That's just, I think, a more traditionalist idiom for some of what Jess is taking a more modernist way of approaching.
I was going to bring that line from Psalms that when I was reading Michael Fishbane, amazing, reminds us that in Psalm 106, we get this recapitulation of the Pinchas story. And in that line, Vayamod Pinchas v'yifalel, Pinchas stands up and somehow intervenes, but the scene is rendered completely differently. And it's intratextual. We're still in Tanakh. So there's clearly discomfort that's being met with a lexicon that allows us to have a different or at least a more expansive view of how this should be read or understood. Because if Pinchas stands up and prays or intervenes, and that's v'ta'atzar hamagefa. That's how the plague is halted. That's very, very different than Pinchas standing up and murdering people. And I love that that's intertextual. It's fascinating.
And I appreciate. I just have to say, I really appreciate the idea that none of this has to be presidential. I'm going through the Torah for the first time in a long time, and it feels like each thing is supposed to have this kind of weight of setting precedent, and we're supposed to look at this thing to set up law. And it's nice to know that maybe that doesn't have that full weight. But I'd love to talk about idolatry for a sec. Shai, you've written extensively on Heschel and idolatry, and we're very excited to revisit some Heschel in today's episode. Specifically, we loved this quote. Why is the Torah so concerned with idolatry? Why are graven images forbidden? You might think it is because God has no image, so any image of God is therefore a distortion. But it is precisely because God has an image that idols are forbidden. You are the image of God. But the only medium in which you can shape that image is that of your entire life. To take anything less than a full, living, breathing human being and try to create God's image out of it, that diminishes the divine and is considered idolatry. You can't make God's image. You can only be God's image. Would you be so kind to expand on this theory for us?
Let me start with this, okay? In order to understand Heschel's theory of idolatry, we have to first understand what it means for human beings to be created in the image of God. And I will say here that among modern scholars, there tend to be roughly two approaches. One approach is that to be created in the image of God is to be appointed by God to be God's vice regent on earth, to rule the earth on God's behalf. Every king needs, you know, delegates who do God's work, vice presidents, if you will, vice regents. And so that is the role of the human being. And that's what Genesis 1:26 says, and let them rule over, et cetera, et cetera. The other view that is most radical in a way, and that scandalizes anyone who's ever studied Maimonides, is that what it means to be created in the image of God is that on some level, we look like God, that there is some way in which the human form looks like the divine form, or if you prefer, the divine form in some way looks like the human form, depending on how you want to imagine this. Now, we could spend hours talking about what that does and doesn't mean, what scholars think it might and might not mean, but the point is the idea that on some level, humans look like the divine. And by the way, it seems clear that the sages of the Talmud thought that that was the meaning of Tzelem Elohim. Very frequently, they translate the word Tzelem, image, as ikonia in Aramaic. Ikonia is not really Aramaic, it's Greek for icon. A human being is an icon, a visual representation of the divine. Sure. There is a midrash in Genesis Rabbah in the rabbinic collection on Breishit that is simply stunning, that imagines the scene that God creates the human being and the angels get confused and start wanting to say Domini, our God. They want to sing songs of praise to the human being, and God freaks out and says, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. That's not God. That's like a picture I made. And so God puts Adam to sleep. And they realize, oh, gods don't sleep. That's not God. That's just the vice president. Now, what are they talking about? There's a stunning midrash, right? Where the rabbis are not going to stop and say, well, you know, human beings look like God. But in a set of imagery, they're going to evoke that possibility that on some level, the human form looks like God's. I will just speak personally, a 1 minute interjection here, that as much as I don't think God is a visual, physical form, I do find this incredibly moving, because what it says is, what is the image of God is not some ethereal quality that you or I have, but it is us in all our flesh and blood embodiedness. My leg is a Tzelem Elohim, if you forgive me for that, you know, goodness, right? There's a way in which we are embodied beings all the way down. And I think there's something very moving about that. Now, what does all that have to do with idolatry? So Heschel, as was his way, makes a comment in a speech in 1963, one of his most famous speeches called the Religion and Race speech about civil rights. And nobody really takes it seriously as pshat, as the plain sense of the text. They think it's a homily. More recently, Bible scholars have in large numbers started adopting this as, no, this is what Genesis actually means. So this is what the Torah actually means. So let's talk about this for a second. The word for images, one of the words for prohibited images is tzlamim, the plural of tzelem, images. And another word for that which cannot be made of God is a dmut. Isaiah asks, el mi tidamyuni, what will you make that looks like me, God? Heschel then observed that when the Torah says, Na'ase Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu, let us make a human being in our image after our likeness, the reason for the prohibition is not that there can be no visual representations of God, but rather that there can only be one, and that is the human being. Idolatry represents an assault not only on God, but on the radical uniqueness and value of the human being as the lone visual representation of God in the world. Now, again, as I said, like that's this beautiful idea. No one really pays attention to it. And then lo and behold, in the 2000s, this is an idea that is spreading wider and wider in biblical studies. One particularly moving kind of manifestation of it that I want to sort of throw into the conversation here, and we can hopefully you guys can add to this. There's a Bible scholar, an evangelical Christian Bible scholar named Richard Lintz, who in a recent book makes like this really interesting comment where he says, oh, all of this really clarifies what the sin of idolatry is. Human beings are created to be reflectors. And when we make idols, which are by definition pictures from our own imaginations of our own self on some level, we make ourselves the reflected instead of the reflector. We're not supposed to make images, we're supposed to be images. And so it's a usurping of a role that belongs to God. God is the one who is to be reflected, and we are put in this world to be reflectors. But we, in our idolatry, in our excessive self-assertion, end up insisting instead that we want to make images of ourselves. Sorry, that was a long response, but I think it's just incredibly rich provocation that Heschel offers, and then that really is kind of alive now in biblical studies in a fascinating way.
You said excessive self-assertion, which is just mm-hmm. so potent. It's so potent. And it's this moment. It's right now. It's the way that we assert the self. It's selfishness as opposed to self-centeredness. I don't think there's anything wrong with centering the self, but there is something wrong with asserting the self. And I know, Raviv, you're going to go into this more, but like how that actually, what's the balance there and how we navigate that as human beings in the world who want to be inspired by the text.
Yeah. So here, though, I think it's interesting to say, you know, for Heschel, decentering the self is the goal of all spiritual life. So he would sort of use different language than you would. You might be saying the same thing in different ways. You know, for him, it's all about self-transcendence. Human beings have a tendency to say I. And the spiritual life is in some ways about teaching us to say you instead. But what's interesting is that in Christian contexts, at least, and I think this is really like interesting from a feminist perspective, there were a series of Christian theologians in the 20th century who essentially defined sin as too much self. Most famously, Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr, two very well-known Christian figures. And feminist Christian theologians came along and said, wait a minute, all of this talk about too much self is irreducibly masculine. Men have the problem of too much self. Women, all too frequently in our culture, remember, we're writing here in the 1970s, have too little self. And in fact, we can say there's two forms of sin. There's the sin of having too much self, and there's also the sin of having too little self. And if you tell people who have too little self that they should work on having even less self, you're actually committing a kind of act of violence against them, whether or not you intend to. So I think it's just interesting to think about this language of how we use the language of selfhood. It's a really rich question, theologically, spiritually, psychologically.
I mean, Rabbi, just... You said we go into it later, but I'm curious now, what is the difference between selfishness and self-centeredness? How do we kind of split those two?
It's all about the orange juice in the fridge, okay? You go to the fridge, there's only a little bit of orange juice left. Okay, the selfish person drinks the orange juice. I want the orange juice, I'm going to drink the orange juice, okay? That's all it is. We've sure. all been there, okay? The self-centered person, centering on the self, I'm home. I want the orange juice. I'm going to make sure after I drink the orange juice that I either put it on the grocery list or go buy more because I'm not an asshole. Okay. So like that's the essential difference. And in neither of those cases are we saying don't drink the orange juice. And I think there's a feminist perspective here too. Whereas for a long time, women were like, you know what, honey, don't drink the orange juice. It's not for you. And now I think women are, and I don't mean to, you know, push a binary here. I think that the gender spectrum, there's a lot to learn here about how we approach gender and sexuality. And this comes up over and over again in the stories of idolatry in the Torah, right? It's who you are as a human being and how you take up space and the ways in which you can transcend the space that you take up. And I think in that sense, maybe I do disagree with Heschel a little bit on like the ultimate goal of spirituality being the transcendence of self, because I would argue that you can't, I wouldn't want to totally transcend the self.
He means what you mean. So I think it's useful to talk about this for just one second, even though it seems like it's far away from the parsha. I think it's actually quite important. He's very clear. He says, you cannot be an organic form of life. You cannot be alive without a concern for self. The mm-hmm. problem is that he thinks modernity creates a world in which people focus only on self. And his argument is that makes you on some level less than human. right? When you are only like any other self-seeking organic being, you know, you, if your only focus is on what do I need, you have not yet become fully human, because the human always makes space for the other as well. I mean, he'll talk about, for example, how like there's a spiritual art of learning to say no to oneself, right? That sometimes, you know, I want this. What do you mean? No, I want this. Right. But if you do this, you're going to hurt someone else.
Was he also talking about orange juice?
Exactly. People don't know this, but he has a book called God in Search of Orange Juice that I'm putting out a critical edition of right now. Yeah. No. So I think that that's actually a very powerful, you know, this is wonderful. This is like the social justice side of Heschel in this amazing way. It's a famous story about Heschel walking into his classroom of rabbinical students at JTS. And he says, blood spots on eggs, kosher or not kosher? The students all say, not kosher, of course. And he says, what about blood spots on your dollar bills? Kosher or not kosher? And that's the sort of like, yes, but if you do this, someone else will be hurt. And that's part of what the spiritual life is. And that's one of the things in my own writing, Lahavdil, in my own writing, I've tried to emphasize this point a lot, which is that I think at the end of the day, when you live inside of the language of Torah, the line between ethics and spirituality is almost invisible. Because, right, at a certain level, if you want to worship, as I always like to say, if you want to worship a God who loves widows and orphans, well, then you have to learn how to love widows and orphans too. And if you love widows and orphans, that's an unavoidably political set of questions. What do you do to protect the weak, the vulnerable, the defenseless? What do you do? So you know, they are ethics, theology, spirituality, they're all interwoven with one another. I think Heschel got that very, very intuitively. It was fundamental to his experience of the world. And by the way, it would be interesting. He never wrote about this. It'd be interesting to know what Heschel, who had so much to say about idolatry in that way, would have made of Pinchas. One of the things I think is really striking about Heschel is that for all his obsession with Tanakh, with the Hebrew Bible, his obsession is really with the prophets. He writes very little about the Torah.
Yeah.
I mean, he writes a book about the prophets. Moses is not a figure in that book. He writes about the theology of the prophets, and Isaiah and Jeremiah and the minor prophets are everything. So, you know, we don't have Heschel's kind of Perush on the Chumash. We don't have that. We don't know what he thought about some of these stories and how he either did or would have taught them. I think it's a set of fascinating questions.
If you are looking to feel A, joyful, B, connected, C, grounded, or D, all of the above, then Shabbat dinner might be just what you're looking for. At One Table, we're on a mission to help 20 and 30-somethings find some magic in the world's oldest wellness ritual. Whether Shabbat means setting the table with fine china or eating takeout on the couch, One Table is here to help you bring a sense of intentionality and space to the end of your week. Ready to find out what Shabbat means to you? Check out onetable.org to get started. You brought this back to idolatry, and there's some kind of writing in the Torah that feels like idolatry itself is somehow threatening God, that by worshiping something other than God, it puts God in danger. Is that the reading here, or is it that idolatry is a threat to us? How are we supposed to understand?
In this story?
In this story and throughout.
Well, you see, here's where I very slightly disagree with Jess, if I'm permitted to do this. Where I slightly disagree with Jess is only in that I think the Torah is concerned with idolatry, not only because it's an offense against God, but also because it sees the survival and flourishing of the covenant community as absolutely critical, and it is terrified of anything that calls that into question. That survival of that covenant community is not some American Jewish self-obsession with continuity. It's about there needs to be a covenant people who affirm God and live in a way that reflects God's ideals for the world. You need a community that's centered around Avodat Hashem, the worship of God. And so, you know, Israelite leadership starting to have relations with non-Israelite women is threatening. Okay. And now I am not here to defend Pinchas going around slaughtering people, but I think it's important to understand what animates that, which is the desire for a community to thrive. It's the same thing that elicits violence, for example, against the person in the Bible who violates the Shabbat, right? Which is on some level, such a mod from a modern perspective, so disturbing, where you kill someone for collecting stones on Shabbat. And yet what is animating that text is the sense that without Shabbat as the fundamental testimony to who God is, that God created the world and took us out of Egypt, without Shabbat, you have no covenant left. And so the very project of covenant is on the line. Now, we might want to find other ways of, you know, grappling with that. But I think the problem of Jews sometimes not putting enough weight on the necessity of there being a viable, vibrant Jewish community oriented around covenant, that's a problem we are far from over in this country. One could say the Jewish community in this country has a problem precisely with not affirming that. Again, I'm not trying to defend the violence of violent text. That is not my project here at all. I just think it's interesting to see what may animate the Torah in its passion about the issues, which end up being expressed in violent ways.
Okay, wait, I have to say that it's an incredible honor. Shai Held disagreed with me, and we should all take note. This is amazing. I'm just so excited that we're... you can edit this out, Raviv, but like, I'm going to fangirl right now, and I get to, just for a second.
You do, you do. You deserve this.
So here's my beef, Shai. I actually agree with you. I think that the
I don't even know if we're really disagreeing. I'm just
we're not actually disagreeing. Anyway. But like that you. I'm gonna lean into it because it felt really. It made me feel.
Go for it. Whatever works for you.
So some of the parallels here between the story, our story with Pinchas and the Egel Hazahav, the golden calf. So mm-hmm. in both situations, and again, the issue for me is partly the way in which I feel women are represented or misrepresented in the text mm-hmm. and the role yeah, in right. which the Moabite and Midianite women are playing, and the beautiful, and again, mostly modern commentaries that have talked about the role of this woman who is later named, right? Later in the chapter, Cozbi, my lie, my deceit, like her name is very powerful, and that somehow she has the power to lure or, get this guy, you know.
I'm totally with you on this side of it, for sure. Yeah. Right? The construction of the woman as the dangerous temptress is hugely problematic. Mm-hmm. Agreed. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, not at all. And I'm just thinking back to the golden calf, which is like the Hirsch commentary around Moshe coming down with the tablets. And it's not the calf that's the problem. It's the orgiastic stuff going on around the calf. That's the problem. So one of the questions I always land on is, what is the relationship between idolatry and the way in which we are using our bodies, our physical selves, our corporeal selves, particularly the power that comes with being sexual beings? I'm just curious what resonates with you there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, that's you're holding this text up from an angle I have to confess I haven't really thought through. I definitely agree that the assumption, I think, that is widespread, my sense is widespread in the ancient world, as woman is the representation of the danger. And in that sense, the Torah does not transcend its environment, right? In other words, it plays that same idea. I totally share that sense. There's something like profoundly worrying about that. And I think that's part of almost of necessity how a patriarchal culture thinks about danger, right? If men are the leaders, and the assumption obviously is heteronormativity, then the danger is going to be women other than the person's spouse, right? Something like that. I don't know. I'm not actually answering your question very well at all. Or responding to your comment, I should say. The thing that I'm a little tripped up by in what you said, and maybe I can turn this question back to you and ask you what you mean by it, is that what's interesting about biblical ritual is that the worship of Hashem, the worship of God, is itself profoundly embodied, right? I mean, the whole sacrificial cult is so physical. It's so raw and almost primal, right? You know, it's like the temple is like filled with spilled blood. It's, you know, from a certain modern perspective, it's revolting. From a certain anthropological perspective, it's like what makes stuff real. It's blood and guts, right? It's like, is it that somehow idolatry, or maybe I misunderstood you, but is idolatry somehow more related to our full embodied selves than worship of God is? I'm confused by that.
Think about this a lot. So one piece of this for me is that if we are in full possession of our bodies, and if we are using the power that comes with that possession in directed in the right way, and I'll go back to something you said earlier, and you may have been quoting Heschel about spirituality and ethics being so intimately linked that you shouldn't be able to disentangle them. And that if we are using our bodies in that way, our the power of our corporeal selves, then part of what happens is consensual, potent, pleasurable, productive sexual relationships. And if we are not, then one of the results, at least as it is rendered in the text, is idolatry. It's a transgression against God, but it's also a transgression against the self. And that's why I think you have this language around Pinchas taking the spear. And I think JPS translates this as stabbing her, Cosby, the woman, through the belly. He didn't talk about stabbing her through the belly. He stabs her in the vagina. Like, the language feels very visceral and real, and it's painful and it's profound. And Alter does a beautiful rendering of this, where he talks about this word kubeh and its roots in Semitic languages as being alcove or room, and how that gets moved both into the body. What's the tabernacle of the self? What's our mishkan? What's my mishkan as a woman? Where am I closest to God? Where am I at my most creative? And there's something powerfully and potently sexual about that. And so when he assaults her, when he murders her, that's what's attacked. We could go on and on. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. But it's also really painful and scary to grapple with.
I have a feeling what the Bible itself would say, quite a ridiculously grandiose thing to say, but I have a feeling what the Bible would say is, I'm not threatened by sexuality. I'm threatened by sexuality that's totally boundaryless, right? I mean, I think you can't understand the beginning of Genesis of, you know, Adam and Eve being, you know, becoming one flesh, lebasar echad, and say that the text is like totally, you know, against embodiedness. In fact, I think one thing that's interesting about the Bible, as opposed to some rabbinic literature, is that it doesn't have this mind-body dualism and this, or heart-body dualism or soul-body dualism, as you find once you're impacted by Greek culture. So, you know, the danger is that in a modern context, people often respond to this, I think, sort of reflexively by saying it's prudish. But there's a way in which I think that the Chumash is really interested in the question of how can sexuality be alive, potent, vibrant, and yet not be a horrifically destructive force? And honestly, I think about that a lot in all kinds of ways. I mean, one of the ways, and here maybe we're wandering very far afield, is, you know, the question of the Catholic Church may never recover from the degree of scandal around utterly boundaryless eros. Right now, of course, you can say, well, wait a minute, that's totally different. Assaulting a child is a totally different thing, and I agree with that. But I just think there's something about the human condition where the sexual urge runs wild. And one of the things that religion is about is asking us to see if we can find a way to sanctify rather than simply give in to the sexual urge. Now, the problem is that has hurt so many people, right? I mean, the number of people who found themselves attracted to people of the same sex and who were told in traditional religious communities, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, whatever, that they were, you know, abominable. I think in a funny way, we might need to constantly be revising and rethinking what is the kind of sexuality that can be sacred and what is the kind that is inherently violative or degrading, right? But those questions strike me as very important. And I think Pinchas, for all the limits that we bump up to as moderns in reading this story, invites us to engage with that question. What are the kinds of sexuality that we believe can be rendered within the boundaries of holiness, of sacredness, etc.? Because I don't think biblical theology is in any way really anti-body. I don't think that's actually something that one can say.
I just totally agree. I think it's beautiful. It's beautiful that a story that can be so troubling can also give rise to a conversation that's so necessary. And one of the things Raviv and I were talking about is like, what's the now what? Like, what, so what, now what? Like, what's the now what with Pinchas? What are you supposed to do with this? And there's so much that you can do with this. And it's not something that tells me about what life may have been like then. It's something that helps me frame what I want my life to be like now, because I'm navigating these choices right now. I want to be a sexual being in the world, and I want to do that in a way that connects to who I am as a Jew in the world. And that's what I find to be inspiring about this. And I'll leave it off there, but I think, you know, with this idea of take it the next step in your relationships with each other and your relationships to social media and how you're projecting or rendering the self online. Take it to the next step in thinking about your own power dynamics in your relationships, but also collegially and in your friendships. And what does that look like for you? That Pinchas right. actually leaves us with this way of being in the world.
Rabbi Jess Minin, thank you so much for being here for the first episode of Co-Hosting with the Study. It's just so good to have you think through all of this Torah. And Rabbi Shai Held, thank you so much. What an honor to be in conversation to talk through this Parsha and a lot more. Shabbat Shalom to you both.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thanks for having me.
The Study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Rabbi Jessica Minin. Our guest was Rabbi Shai Held. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.